You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. You can also find us online at www.cjsf.ca, or you can call us at 778-782-CJSF.
How do we become a sustainable world? As the stakes for our survival continues to rise, so does our global consciousness. We are in the midst of a great spiritual awakening and are laying the foundations for a happy, peaceful, just, and sustainable world. With clear vision, determination, and a positive attitude, we are making sustainability happen. The transformation is already underway. You are listening to Sustainable Futures.
And as I say, I just don't know enough about the specifics of the housing promises and to how well, which ones did and didn't get delivered out on, to be able to say much about, you know, what specifically ought to be done differently. But for sure, you know, there's aspects to the way this event runs that can have really negative consequences, and they need to be looked at.
This is Ryan Fletcher of Sustainable Futures with Tim Reeve of Reeve Consulting. And first of all, you're president of Reeve Consulting. And thank you very much for taking your time to come up here and talk with us here today.
You're absolutely welcome, Ryan. My pleasure. It's great to be here.
So we're going to talk first about Reeve Consulting. I'll just open up with what is Reeve Consulting? What does Reeve Consulting do?
We are a Vancouver-based consulting firm that specializes in sustainability strategy. We work with municipalities, private sector organizations, and the Olympic Games. And we're probably the only firm in Canada that specializes specifically in ethical and sustainable purchasing. We really work on helping companies buy responsible and sustainable products and work with responsible and sustainable suppliers and use that as a way to advance their sustainability objectives. So we're a strategy firm that really works on sustainability and a certain aspect of sustainability to make progress.
And what is the origins of the company? Where did this idea of having a sustainable purchasing firm come from?
Yeah, great question. The firm itself is in its sixth year of operations. We're Vancouver-based, as am I. I grew up here in Vancouver. And I had been working in a variety of capacities, either on staff or within larger consulting firms, doing sustainability and environmentally related work. I was seconded to the 2010 Bid Corporation to work for almost a year on green plans for what's crazy now, but a potential 2010 Games back then. After Vancouver was successful in winning the bid for the Games, I became a new dad and I had a little baby girl, and I wanted to have some flexibility around my work schedule, and I thought that consulting and starting a little firm would be a way to achieve some balance in terms of lifestyle. And we've grown. We're not big, but we're a team of four people, but we've sort of grown steadily and taken on more and more interesting projects over the last 5 or 6 years, and it's great. I love it.
Where did you see the need for this? How did you know there was like a demand for this kind of thing?
Yeah, great question. So I'd done a number of years of work in the environmental sector, more on traditional programs around recycling and waste management for hotels and businesses and municipalities, and often worked colleges and universities. In fact, way back in the day, I used to be part of a network of college university recycling coordinators, and there was a woman named Trish Glanfield that worked on programming up here at SFU, and we worked with others at UBC. And so I gained over a number of years of experience a recognition that purchasing and how people spend their money, how institutions spend their money, has a lot to do with their ability to be zero waste or go carbon neutral or achieve economic development objectives around impoverished folks or whatever the case may be. And that monetary transaction was one that had a big influence on moving sustainability within a company or an organization. And really how you spent your money said a lot about really what your values were. You know, and we know as consumers, we've got choices to make, and we make those all the time. Coffee, tea, office supplies, it's no different for corporations and institutions. So we thought there was a niche there, and some of the specialized work that I'd done on the 2010 bid around sustainability related to purchasing and how that might play out for the Games. And we, in the early years of my firm, had an interest from a couple of different Canadian municipalities to work on ethical purchasing policies to combat sweatshop labor. And so we found that there was a little niche within this growing interest in green and sustainability in this area of supply chain and sustainable purchasing. And so we've come to specialize in that, and that's been a good area for us, for sure.
Now, two words that get tossed around a lot are green and sustainable. Do you think that those are the same? What's the difference, if there is a difference, between green and sustainable?
A really good question. I would say, in fact, that's a bit of a key interest of mine, is sort of the use of language and how we use it to advance this so-called sustainability movement. I think sometimes we tend to get far too hung up on language and terms in particular. My own personal feeling is that I use green and sustainable almost interchangeably in day-to-day conversation, because I think that for most people, they mean about the same thing. They, in fact, you know, sustainability I see as being, of course, much broader. People think of green and largely environmentally related issues. Sustainability, when I think of it, encompasses more around human rights and social conditions, community involvement of corporations, how you interface with your customers, your employees, your stakeholders. So more broadly, sure, than recycling or energy efficiency or some of those things that we often see as green. But I think for the average person, they see them almost the same. And when they think green, they also think some of these other things as well. At the end of the day, I think call it whatever people understand, and let's get on with the doing and the action stuff and not worry so much about exactly what it's called. Very quick aside, because I told you it was a bit of a hot button for me, was that back in the day when I worked at GVRD or Metro Vancouver, we did a lot of market research, and people would self-declare that they did composting in the backyard, and they called it recycling. They also called watering their lawn every other day a form of recycling activity that they did. And buying things with less packaging or non-toxic cleaners, they also called the activity of recycling. In ways, in actuality, there are subtle little differences between clean purchasing and non-toxic water reduction for your lawn. But nonetheless, the general public would call them recycling. And that just demonstrates to me that use a terminology. If they call it recycling and it's something else, but they're doing it, great. That's what we want.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So we're here to talk a lot about the Olympics, and what is the role of Reeves Consulting being for this Olympics?
We've really had a couple of different roles as the project's evolved over the last effectively 7 years. we got involved initially as sort of an advisor and a consultant of sorts on staff during the bid phase and during the latter part of 2002 and the first 7 or 8 months of 2003, leading up to that July decision to have the games here in Vancouver. We were working with staff in the bid corporation on green plans for the bid proposal and to help fast track anything that might happen if Vancouver was indeed awarded the games. At that time, we'd help do action plans related to a number of potential green or sustainability initiatives, and purchasing and management systems and reporting were a couple of the areas that we did some specialty work in. Then, I guess, Ryan, after that, once the organizing committee was formed, we went, and I had formed my own company, we went on to do some consulting work directly for VanOck and the organizing committee, specifically in the area of their ethical purchasing and anti-sweatshop programs, and also their general green and sustainable purchasing work. And then more recently, we've been a bit of more of an observer and spectator and participant in the games themselves and ceremonies. And we've been doing some preliminary research for Sochi 2014. So we have some work now that we've started with the next Winter Olympics. So we're sort of information gathering and doing knowledge transfer from this Games to help plan the next one.
Okay. And in your opinion, do you think the 2010 Olympics was a successful showcase of sustainability?
I think it was successful in many ways, and there were areas where there obviously perhaps could have been even more progress made, things that we might do differently if we had the chance to do it over again, as is often the way with big projects. So, you know, I think that there was a number of firsts with these Olympics in terms of sustainability, green programming, work on ethical sourcing, and lots of things that the organizers, perhaps during the bid, certainly during the organizing and hosting phase, can feel really proud of, and the community too, because it involved a whole lot of different people from municipalities, local groups, academics, NGOs. So there was a lot of collaboration on the many good things that did happen. And I can speak to, you know, a number of those. You know, on the other hand, you know, when we see the magnitude of the event itself and how many people around the world to some extent plug in to this event to take away some messages, personally, I feel like there was some opportunities to try and do even deeper engagement with those people while we had their attention to try and communicate maybe a even stronger greener sustainability message, a call to action of some sort to help raise spectators and TV viewers and athletes' recognition of some of these events. I think there were some good things that were tried, but I'm not sure we realized how big the opportunity might be. You know, you've got practically every, I don't know what the stats were exactly, but some enormous number of Canadians, half or more, watching that gold medal hockey's game.
Yeah, right, you know,
and so if we could have had, like, you know, Go Canada, Go Green as part of that mantra that people embraced for that day or that afternoon or that two-week period, and that Go Canada, Go Green, you know, translated into something that, you know, some little thing that people changed in their lives, but that was everlasting. Taking the bus once a week, doing some composting, carrying your coffee mug. At that level, for Canadians and maybe even globally, some little shift in thinking. These Olympics provide that opportunity, and I think we really need to look for every way we can leverage what Vancouver did and do even more of that in London and, you know, hopefully Sochi too, because they are so of such a scale that you've got people's attention at that moment, and if we can use it to do other good things as well, then I think they really start to do tip into that worth it balance.
Okay. If you look at the nature of the Olympic Committee, the IOC, it's got an interesting thing as far as sustainability is concerned. This is a really big corporation that will go into towns every 2 years and develop in that area and then go. Being a corporation, there is also a profit motive there. And what's it like working with such an organization that kind of acts like it just sucks all of this resource out of an area and then goes to the next one? How do you work with that in a way that makes something that's more sustainable, more long-term, more... And you're talking about community. It's very difficult to create community out of someone that's coming from away and leaving right after. Right. So how does that all fit in?
Yeah, great question. So let me sort of take one at a time there. Your question about community and how do you build that when you've got such an obvious influx and exodus of participants and, organizers, etc. The whole idea of sort of going from one city to another every couple of years and hosting this mega event and what are its impacts vis-a-vis sustainability, again, really good question. So let me start there. Self-declare right off the bat. I'm not sure I could tell you this afternoon, Ryan, that I've got an answer. What I know is that to some extent, whether one is really a huge Olympic booster or feeling concerned or even downright certain that they're a bad idea because of these impacts, and let's be honest, there are big impacts, they're going to be around for a little while. And I guess certainly my own personal philosophy has been is that I'm a little bit more of an in-the-tent kind of guy. Our firm is a little bit more like that than outside. We know these things are going to happen. How can we try and help reduce the size of the footprint as much as possible, do it in a positive way, and hopefully spin a message that's going to get others excited or interested and that little, that ripple stuff. More practically, in the case here of Vancouver, I think there was a pretty good attempt made to build facilities that would have some really useful turnover for the community in terms of recreational infrastructure and to do it. These buildings were an Olympic first in terms of just the degree of greenness within the buildings, the whole LEED silver and gold program that most of them met. That was certainly very innovative. As far as buildings themselves go, they're certainly, first class state of the art type facilities. Most of them, I believe, are going to transition into, solid community facilities with reasonable operating costs, because that's often a big deal with these Olympics.
They're also way over budget.
Yeah, absolutely. No question about it. The price tag overall was way out of line, I think, with what had been projected at the beginning. No disputing that at all. I think about an example like Athens. And the amount of money that was spent to build the facilities, the rush work that really was at the end of the day, resulting in less quality, and the degradation of those facilities so quickly after the games ended, and the huge cost to the Greek people and and Greece. And now look at some of the stuff. I'm not drawing a direct line there, but I do think it's a very, very valid question. When done poorly, or when put into a place that really has no capacity to either build it effectively or maintain it for a useful purpose for the community, you really do have to question, hey, is this the right decision? And so I think it's a really valid question. There needs to be, I think, more criteria around how that's going to really benefit a region in a more sustainable way, be it on the environmental, the economic, and the social side, than perhaps has been done. It'd be nice to see the IOC pay even more attention to that in their bid evaluation phase for cities. And I think certainly the idea of repeating within cities that have built the infrastructure and have the capacity to host. But those would be small changes. The fundamental, the big hairy audacious, shift, so to speak, in my opinion, I don't know if it's going to happen. It's not something we're actively working on, but the idea intrigues me. And that is, would be perhaps to re-envision the entire event entirely. And perhaps as instead of a mega sporting event in a central location, it's some, more network of events and specialized sports held all over the world, but simultaneously. And
that would be interesting.
Where you're not necessarily having people all traveling to one place. The need for concentration of facilities in one community is diminished. You could repeat through places and still feel like you are including all kinds of places. It's not an idea I've given lots of thought to, but the question you've asked is one I think people will grapple with. Finishing up on that, here in Vancouver particularly, I would say the story still remains to be told. You're right. Look at the projections on budget costs for building things, particularly, and in some cases way out of line. We've also heard what the costs will be, to maintain some of these facilities and how people will be able to use them, or they'll be turned into tourist things with a certain revenue stream. Or that's going to need a year or two at least to play out to see even what the trend line looks like and if those questions and projections were correct. We took a leap of faith when we did this, I think, in terms of as a community and as a taxpayers and as a country. I think a lot of people feel positive. to really know the whole story, it's going to take a little while. It took 7 years to plan, to win the bid. Well, more than that, but to plan and host took 7 years. It'll at least take a few more, say three, for 10 years in total, I think, for us to really begin to say objectively, you know, was that billion or two or 6 billion really worth it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one inherent problem with the capitalist model is that something that has cost so much to build will need to generate an equal amount of revenue for whoever's running that building, which is going to make it very difficult to make it into something that's social housing for people that are being neglected by the system, which was a big story of the Olympics. In fact, a lot of people were losing housing. There was less housing available in the Olympics, and a big protest at Tent City about social housing and the fact that the lower income population of Vancouver, which is very significant, was not getting a good deal here.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to look at that. And I guess I want to ask you, do you think there is possibility of these original intentions, stated intentions, of having better housing for lower income people is a realistic thing now?
Let me start with a couple observations right off the bat. Mm-hmm. You know, one would be that I've got to say that the housing element of how the games have played out is not an area that I've been as close to mm-hmm. on the sustainability file. I'll tell you what I think I know, but I'm going to say I really don't know the whole story
sure.
on housing.
Yeah.
Secondly is that there definitely were promises and commitments made during the bid phase around housing and that indeed was, I think, a big part of the promise to the community mm-hmm. was that we would see some big shifts
yeah.
in this regard.
It was certainly big for the local population.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm not sure that as you walk around the community and look visually, if people see a significant difference to 4 or 6 or 8 years ago around the time when the bid was created and awarded. Whether or not behind the scenes some of the things have started to be put into place that will play out over the next few years or more to perhaps really start to see that change and improvement for so many people, I'm less certain about, because as I say, I don't know the details behind mm-hmm. you know some of the programs that have been put into place. If anything, I think you know probably not enough may have been done, or it wasn't coordinated in a way to move at the pace that was required to really lift people up significantly over the last, say, 5 to 10 years. I think we still have a really large and visible homeless population.
A lot of statistics I hear are saying that it has doubled in that time and gotten much larger.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that in itself, if that's true, you know, is a real indicator. The things that were put in place, you know, weren't nearly as successful as mm-hmm. everybody had hoped. And I think people really need to take a hard look and say, well, why is that the case?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when it comes to building a highway or a rapid transit line from the airport or a facility, you know, every effort is made to ensure that those things are done on time mm-hmm. and in place by a certain deadline.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that people didn't try exceptionally hard on the homeless and the housing situation. Those are certainly longstanding issues that we've had to deal with. So I'm not suggesting for a moment people didn't work hard, but that sense of collective urgency to get to a certain finish point by a certain time may not have been there in the same way as it is sometimes mm-hmm. for other projects. I think that reflects our priorities, yeah. and sometimes it's disappointing.
It's difficult if you're looking from the perspective of a lower income resident and how all of these buildings went up so fast for other concerns. In the meantime, you're losing your housing.
Yeah.
And so you see these figures of big dollar figures of going into buildings and things. In the meantime, your own interest as a citizen of that very city is just being stolen from you. And
yeah,
I think that's
a big reason
why there was this big Tent City protest.
Yeah. You know, I'm not sure if I would say stolen particularly, but the sentiment you're expressing and the
yeah.
frustration that I'm sure some folks feel,
yeah.
I can fully understand. I think the Tent City, again, in many ways, hopefully, it's going to serve to try and catalyze, you know, people who are working on these issues and those that should be and who are not, you know, to take it on with a more of a sense of urgency. Because I don't think anybody would dispute that it is really a horrific situation that we have so many people that are living in such a destitute kind of situation, and everybody should have some kind of decent housing. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's a call to action to us as Vancouverites. This yeah. problem existed before the Olympics. The Olympics made a lot of promises about trying to improve it. Probably some have been delivered and many have not been. And we're going to have to continue to chip away at this. And the Olympics wasn't going to solve it. But hopefully, for whatever work it has done, it catalyzes attention and brings a greater sense of urgency. You know, we did a great job in many ways on lots of technical things around the Olympics. Let's use that as some lessons on how we can attack this problem in a more effective way.
Well, one thing that could be talked about is how we have a lot of lower income housing that was in place when the Olympic bid came through. But then things like low income residences in the downtown east side that are these old buildings, their interest, kind of the owners of the buildings started to have an interest of, well, as a business, this is a great opportunity to sell this property and make it more of an attractive place to go. And a lot of the low-income housing was disappearing. They were getting evictions from their houses so that they could renovate the buildings and then market it. So that's how the homeless population grew during this time. Maybe looking towards the future, that's something that could be looked at, because there is this inherent interest in the capital system for profit. And when such an opportunity as the Olympics comes along, my own opinion is, because of the system we're under, things like this can happen.
Yeah, I think you've described some system conditions which absolutely can feed into that. And as I say, I just don't know enough about the specifics of the housing promises and to how well, which ones did and didn't get delivered out on, to be able to say much about, you know, what specifically ought to be done differently. But for sure, you know, there's the, you know, there's aspects to the way this event runs that can have really negative consequences, and they need to be looked at.
Let's see if we can maybe draw on this a little bit more. So going back to more of a general view, what kind of legacy do you think the Olympics will have towards the future for citizens of Vancouver?
Well, I would say probably several things come to mind. You know, if I think on an environmental basis, I think we've got some outstanding buildings, green buildings, that have been created. And these will be showcase facilities. And so people who are interested in green building and, you know, adopting these kinds of practices and techniques and technologies, you know, the Vancouver Olympic facilities will certainly be great sort of showcasing opportunities in that regard. So for others across the province or the country or internationally, as more people get hip to green building, which is a great thing, then these venues will be really helpful in that regard and will promote Vancouver and Vancouver designers and architects and construction technology people should get business opportunities out of that as well. In and of themselves, hopefully, they're going to be great recreational facilities for folks locally, at least a good chunk of them. Some of them I feel a little less certain about, but you know, most of them I think are enhancements or will be things that Vancouverites and others will really make great use of. So, you know, can we complement that perhaps in terms of things that we might do more of or could have done more of, you know, on that area particularly? Some pretty alarming statistics about Canadians and health and obesity, etc. Wouldn't it be great if somehow the legacy of these facilities was also some big call and engagement around just getting people more active, a little less time in front of the tube or whatever the case may be? If that could also be wrapped into it as a result of the games and we had more people using these great facilities, you know, that would be a super legacy for our community. On the green side as well, certainly amongst the people that are involved in what I might call the sustainability industry or business or the green technology business, I think there's been lots of connections and many what I might call mini showcasing projects of individual green initiatives around energy efficiency or waste or emissions or transportation, etc. And those people's ability to be kind of advisors and transferers of knowledge to help businesses and communities become greener, sort of that social capital, human capital, in knowledge around green and sustainable, that's been built up. Mm-hmm. But our numbers are only so great. Again, yeah. When you think of the billions that watched the event, or the millions of Canadians who at almost at one moment on a Sunday afternoon, you know, would have done anything that a great superstar would have asked of them once he scored a goal. Mm-hmm. You know, those opportunities to get people to think about an issue and engage in behavior change, I think, still intrigue me in terms of things that could be done with the event. Mm-hmm. Other community legacies, for sure, on the economic side. I mean, one thing that I think is really indisputable is that the engagement with our Aboriginal people around these games was incredible and really successful. Mm-hmm. And the work with having First Nations involved in the bid, on the board of directors, through economic development, all above and beyond just the opening and closing ceremonies and things where people might naturally have expected there to be some degree of involvement there. That whole legacy around sort of Aboriginal economic development in some of the host nations here in the Lower Mainland, as well as some others, but particularly in the Lower Mainland, I think has been super positive. All kinds of great business stories there. Mm-hmm. And some real positive role models for the community, both in athletics and in business and in organizing, evolving, which I think will hopefully be a great legacy for our First Nation people, and particularly young people who are looking to the future and thinking about what kind of opportunities do I have as a young Aboriginal person. Now they see people who have been involved in the games in various ways be successful with that and think of that as potentially, you know, again, just seeing positive role models, I think, is something that's important for all kinds of communities, and I think perhaps especially our First Nation communities. So I see that as a positive legacy. You know, on the economic side, you know, probably to be determined, as I said a little earlier, I think there's certainly lots of businesses that either did well during the games or businesses and organizations that see opportunities to become more involved in, you know, games and sporting events or the Pan Am Games in Toronto. But there's always got to be balanced against, you know, what was the cost to put it on. So there's a taxpayer question that we're not really going to know the answers to for a little while. On balance, the sense of pride people seem to largely demonstrate nationally and locally around how the event was hosted, how Canada did as a country, how it made people feel, you know, it seems pretty positive. Was there more that could have been done across a whole number of areas? Absolutely. You know, and those are the areas that are going to be really interesting, in my opinion, to take a look at and say, okay, as we think about 3 or 4 Olympics from now or 6 or 7 Olympics from now and that perhaps transformation to quite a different event or an event done in quite a different way, you know, Vancouver, I think, did a pretty great job in the scheme of all the Olympics. I think people will say, again, lots of firsts. But this is an event that has the opportunity for great impacts, both positive and negative. Let's really zero in on what Vancouver, you know, could have done better at and really look to see that the Londons and the Sochis and the Rios of the world, who are the next 3 hosts, do a better job on.
One of the interesting things about sustainability, business, and the Olympics is image. And a lot of what I see happening in business is centered around this image. And often, it only goes so far as image. For example, a couple of the biggest funders and people that got the most promotions around the Olympics are Coca-Cola and McDonald's. I don't think a researcher has to go very far to start being critical about their practices with sustainability and green development. However, I can see how something like this can be attractive to them, especially because the International Olympic Committee in 2002 put green and sustainability as one of their high priorities in every Olympics that they put forward. I think it was the 3rd priority.
Right, yeah.
So now every Olympic since then has been billed as the greenest Olympics ever, and I'm sure that'll continue. But then because of business, it's inherent that, especially for something that is so costly, it's such big dollar signs around it, it seems that only the biggest corporations get a chance. So how is it that, I'm wondering, how is it that McDonald's and Coca-Cola got involved, and what is that effect being on the Olympics?
Mm-hmm. Well, I can sort of speak to what I know about that. First of all, a couple of things come to mind. You know, Coke and McDonald's, like the Olympic themselves, probably are doing some things exceedingly well that we probably don't know a lot about in terms of the sustainability stuff. I know Coke did some pretty innovative things that kind of caught my attention around recycling, particularly. We'll speak to that in a bit. Mm-hmm. And for sure, you know, as massive corporations have lots of areas where they're having significant impacts that are probably not positive and need to be looked at. So not indifferent, you know, and all organizations are like this, having positive and negative impacts.
But I also wonder, how does it help the local community when such big businesses come in and take all of the money out of the local economy?
Well, you know, I'd need to maybe get you to explain a little bit more about what you mean about taking the money out of the local economy.
That's true. I mean,
there is
no money in the local economy in many cases, right? I mean, these are opportunities that maybe could have gone to more of our local, you know, people representing Vancouver rather than people representing McDonald's and Coca-Cola.
Well, let me paint a little picture and, you know, let's talk about it a bit more. First of all, Coke and McDonald's are referred to. There's different tiers of sponsorship within the Olympics. And the top sphere is these groups called top sponsors. They're the international companies. They negotiate directly with the IOC to become sponsors of the Olympics. And when any particular city gets the games, these people come to the table as sponsors already. You don't choose them as your sponsors.
Okay.
The Canadian companies, the Bells and Hudson's Bay, Petro-Can, Rona's of the world, they negotiate deals directly with the organizing committee, and the organizing committee has a little bit more of an opportunity to seek partners who can both provide them with what they're looking for and reflect the kind of image and values that they're looking for. These top sponsors are inherited, so if you like them or you don't like them, they're part of your team right from the get-go.
Yeah.
Having said that, you know, when the sponsors, be they these top sponsors like Coke and McDonald's or the Bells and Petro-Cans and Rona's and others of the world, when they activate their sponsorship, one thing they do is spend a lot of money in the local economy with providers of goods and services that allow them to do all the promoting that we see going on. So,
you give some examples?
Sure. All of the tent companies, all of the catering companies, all of the event organizing companies, all the videographers, all the people producing television ads and newspaper ads for these organizations. The people,
are they themselves local, though?
Many of them are, and that's where some of the greatest business opportunities for BC businesses come from, is actually working with the sponsors. The organizing committee itself probably spent maybe $1 billion, plus or minus, on goods and services. The collection of the sponsors and the broadcasters and even the Olympic committees for all the countries that came to hire people to do massage and to host them in hotels, or use, you know, Courtney and Comox being a training facility for cross-country skiers. Those people are staying in the community there, buying accommodation, buying food, using catering services, getting medical services. So all those business opportunities are coming to local BC businesses. And there's a whole host of success stories through a group called the 2010 Commerce Center, and in part stimulated by this program, BuySmart, that we worked on with the organizing committee. So, you know, there is a lot of economic activity that's generated locally for BC firms, even though in many instances they're not the logos that you see on the TV, because, you know, the price tag for that kind of sponsorship is huge and usually eclipses.
Well, one effect of that is it cheapens, because I think the general population has a pretty negative image of someone like Coca-Cola and McDonald's so far as sustainability is concerned. When they get tied to the Olympics and the Olympics get tied to sustainable, it has an effect of cheapening the word sustainable and green, I think, in many cases.
Perhaps. I don't know if I agree, but
it'd be interesting to do a survey.
and see if people's perception of the idea of sustainability is diminished as a result of the Olympics.
I know for me it does.
Well, perhaps depending on how one defines, as you said earlier, how does one define sustainability? I would rather think
that... I mean, if you look at the way that people are jumping on the sustainability boat, the more people you include, the less solid you know, you have to accommodate so many different things, all of a sudden it becomes weaker and it weakens until it's just a word.
You know? I guess I see it differently in the sense that, you know, in my opinion, if you require people to meet a certain absolute bar before you can invite them to the party or the conversation, it discourages a lot of folks from taking those first early steps. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, we need to see change both in corporations, in our public institutions, in our own individual behaviors collectively to lighten our footprint on the planet. Mm-hmm. Everybody's got to make some changes. You know, my own personal approach is that, you know, you've got to invite people in and incent them and motivate them to make those changes. I think that's going to be more effective than to say, you know, you're not meeting my definition or standard of what sustainability is, and therefore, you know, we don't want to engage with you at all. Come back to the table or come back to the door when you've sort of done this, this, and this. So, you know, there's a variety of approaches that are probably ultimately going to be successful. I said a little earlier, my own personal approach and that of our firm as well is to be a bit more on the inside the tent, try and get influencers to change and see the benefits of these changes. But, you know, there's greenwashing. I mean, you're alluding, I think, in a way to this idea of greenwashing and corporations painting themselves green.
Yeah,
you
for
know,
sure.
Car, you know, what car isn't advertised these
That's
days
what I'm talking
driving
about.
Through the forest?
Yeah.
And you'd almost think that it was better for the deer to have these things made and driven through the forest. And so for sure, the good news is we've got a more savvy consumer than ever. Folks like yourself are asking these kinds of questions all the time in all kinds of products, let's hope, you know, in terms of products and companies that they're willing to support. The ease of access to information on what people's performance really is improving all the time as well. So I think that's resulting in companies being need to be held more accountable and also consumers getting more information to allow them to make choices that align more with their values. So, you know, for sure, lots of improvement that we need to make. But people are asking lots of the right questions, and people are more and more, in my opinion, are sort of aligning their actions with their values, and that's a good thing at the individual and corporate level. Long way to go still for.
Yeah. I kind of broke into the question. I don't know if there's anything you wanted to say before we went on that track. I kind of lost track myself of what track we were on.
Well, I know, you know, you were asking about sort of benefits for the community, and I was speaking about some of the economic benefits that I thought did come from the games. You know, another one that we feel really proud about is, you know, that these were the first Olympics to have a specific policy around sweatshop labor and child labor. And all of the products that were made for the Olympics with the official Olympic logo on them, the T-shirts, the Inukshuks, the volunteer jackets, and many, many more items, umbrellas, and all kinds of things that were part of their merchandising program, all the factories that made those things had to undergo audits to ensure that they were meeting certain minimum standards around child labor and human rights. And where they were seen to have challenges or issues, they were required to make improvements and to be re-audited. And this was really an Olympic first in terms of bringing that level of rigor to a portion of all the goods and services that were being used, goods particularly. And so that in itself, I think, considering the scale of spending, you know, you allude many times to sort of the economic magnitude of the event, where we can get bits and pieces, you know, eat this elephant one bite at a time. Probably there was about 500 or who knows, maybe $750 million of spending on the logo merchandise. People love the T-shirts and hoodies and mittens and all those things. Knowing it and the volunteers and the athletes' jackets. And so knowing that all of that stuff mostly is now being made free of child labor on a regular go-forward basis and hopefully, again, improving that. You know, that's something that I think from a social economic perspective is a big legacy and a bit of an untold story.
To bring this to the general population, one thing I found that was very interesting while during the Olympics was going on was that so many people were buying these shirts and everything with the Olympic logo and all of that. And I'm wondering how many of these people needed an extra shirt? How many people needed these extra clothes? And how much of this will be worn after the Olympics?
Good question. I wouldn't know.
And then you have to produce the product for the people to sell, and the sell demand to buy on the image of the Olympics is huge because it incorporates national pride. and things like that. And that part of the Olympics went so well with Canada that at times you could walk down the street and the majority of people had a Canadian paraphernalia.
Mm-hmm.
And the lineups at the Bay store were enormous.
Apparently they still are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you add up all of the money that's gone into buying those shirts and put it towards, you know, something that might be a little more needed than another shirt to put on the rack, it's an interesting question.
Sure, yeah. And again, I really wouldn't be able to speak much to sort of individuals, people's
needs. But this is an individual thing as well.
You know, their individual needs or what motivates them to buy, you know, what sort of T-shirt or paraphernalia. I mean, let's face it, we're a pretty brand-oriented society. Consumers in general are geared a lot to their interest in those kinds of things. As in terms of what's motivating any one person, not really for me to say.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that I caught word of, it's not something I've really been able to look into much yet, but there's this question about drinking water, and there was a certain company, and I actually interviewed them, so it's pretty bad that I didn't get to, don't remember what exactly it was, but they had this promotion about tap water. And promoting the use of taps and drinking water from taps. And I just heard recently that they had a lot of trouble getting into the Olympics in the beginning because of Coca-Cola and Dasani water, in that they are having all this, you know, water bottle product. And the fact that tap water really, really threatens that, them getting their Dasani water product to the Olympics. And do you know how that all played out? Because I know the tap water did eventually get in, because I saw them there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I know a little bit about it. Certainly we identified, even back during the bid phase in 2002 and 2003, that things like water, or even any drink container for that matter, that people were going to be using when they were in venues would in large part be determined by whoever was the sponsor of the food and beverages, the Cokes and the McDonald's, and that they would, and again, because of this dynamic that I described, where you as the organizing committee inherit these people and their products and services, these corporations and their products and services, you have to try and negotiate with them, because that's, you're absolutely right, you know, their interest is to use products and packaging that are sort of enhancing their brand or their delivery or their cost effectiveness.
You've got to get the logo on there. You can't put your logo on a tap or a glass of water.
Well, you know, what's
in the cups people are reusing, hopefully, right?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. You know, what's interesting is to see where companies are starting to get creative around this. In the case of the bottles, though, in particular, because it's, you know, a story that I don't know if it got as much profile as it ought to have, and that is that, you know, the new bottles that Coke were using, the plastic water bottles, as well as some of the drink bottles, are showing some of the most latest innovations in plastic water bottle recycling technology.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, where there is at least a need for plastic water bottles or plastic drink containers, Coke did some pretty cool things at this Olympics around using plant-based plastic and a full recycling program for all those bottles. So, again, the impact of a bottle versus tap, indisputable, one over the other. Where you are using that product, at least they're showing some of the newest, coolest stuff around how to manage that effectively.
Well, it's an interesting step. But just then if every single person is having a plastic bottle of water every time they're having a drink during the Olympics even, then that adds up to a lot of bottles. And you might even have a total of bottles that's larger than the population itself. In fact, for Vancouver, you could do that pretty fast.
Well, what's interesting, you know,
but if you want to promote the production of these bottles, you're producing more than one per person, you know?
Yeah, I don't know what the total figures on the bottled water were, or, you know, and you know, part of what I didn't mention was, and again, I don't know a whole lot about it, but I did observe that the tap water, you know, trucks, the mobile tap water stations and things did turn out to be a big hit for those that found out about them or those that did use them. And that's great. You know, again, from kind of a legacy perspective, if the lessons learned, good or bad, on the bottles or the use of the tap could be used to engage people locally to really make that shift, because I think there's already a bit of a groundswell around, you know, bottled water is seen to be a bit taboo. Maybe 5 years from now, it'll be like smoking inside, you know. Who knows how that'll go? Perhaps this will have had a little role to play. But I did want to just mention one thing to put things in context, and that is it's never a good idea to generate waste. But the amount of total garbage from the Olympics the 2 weeks that we had the games on, mm-hmm. was the equivalent to approximately 1 day of regular garbage generation in this region.
Mm-hmm.
So if we generate garbage 365 days a year, it was like in 2010, we had one extra day's worth mm-hmm. as a result of the games. Not to suggest that every effort shouldn't be made to reduce waste and be reusable and eco-efficient, for sure. But if there's a perception that the games left this enormous piles and quickly filled up our disposal capacity in some way and put a big burden on us, it wouldn't really be the right characterization.
Mm-hmm.
So just to put the, you know, sort of the scale of the problem, if everything got chucked out and no recycling took place, and personally I think the recycling program had some areas where it could potentially have been improved.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. You can also find us online at www.cjsf.ca, or you can call us at 778-782-CJSF.